Chapter 18. Endgame. The dawn was cold and clear. There was absolute silence. At the castle, the first prisoners awake climbed to the ramparts and looked down on the town through the pallid morning light. White flags, pillowcases and bedsheets fluttered from the windows of the houses. In the darkness, the SS forces had slipped away and retreated eastwards. Private Bob Hoffman was manning a machine gun overlooking the woods above the Tiergarten when a group of Hitler youth emerged from the trees, still in uniform, but now unarmed, leaderless and very frightened. A few hours earlier, Hoffman would have killed them all. Now they were children again. They looked like a Boy Scout troop, he recalled. We told them to go home. At 5 a.m., 5 miles to the west, Private Alan Murphy of the Task Force Intelligence and Reconnaissance Section was woken in his tent and told to report for duty with 3 other soldiers. Colonel Shaughnessy's orders were to proceed to Colditz and set up an observation post. Once there, occupy a building overlooking the bridge and await the arrival of the battalion communication section, who would run a wire and provide a field phone. Shaughnessy was not going to allow his men to be ambushed a second time. No mention was made that there was a prisoner of war camp in Colditz, Murphy later wrote. The four had trained together at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, as part of the 69th Infantry Division, the Fighting 69th, before sailing for France on the 22nd of January 1945 aboard the Monowai. They had seen action at Camberg and the Rhine before being attached to Task Force Shaughnessy. All were in their 20s. Armed with M1 rifles, hand grenades and ammunition bandoliers crossed over their chests, the 4 GIs set off for Colditz town in the milky dawn. When we reached the bridge, we saw our first Americans, a half dozen infantrymen crouched behind the parapet that bordered the bridge's west bank. The bodies of 2 German soldiers lay in the road, behind the pathetic wire and metal barricade. "There are still snipers over there," said the sergeant in command. "I'm not going to risk my men." A tough Midwestern farm boy, Murphy was up for adventure. He turned to his companions. "Want to try it?" Their orders were to remain by the bridge, but it was tempting to push on over the river. We decided to cross. It was one of those quick decisions that you often have to make in combat. They fixed bayonets, and on the count of 3, they sprinted. We raced up onto the bridge and had to jump over a dead German youth sprawled on his back to the left of a gaping hole in the roadway. The market square was deserted. White sheets hung limply from the windows. The 4 GIs made their way forward in single file, ducking into doorways. At the end of the square, a cobbled street rose steeply. "We'd gone too far to turn back," wrote Murphy. They ran up the narrow alleyway and then stopped. The castle came into view, towering above us. Murphy had been so alert for snipers, he had not spotted it before. A 2-man Anglo-American reception committee was waiting inside the main gate. The Californian captain Guy Nunn, one of the original Sparrows, and Captain David Walker, wearing the full uniform of the Scottish Black Watch Regiment. Both would go on to become novelists and left vivid descriptions of what followed. Nunn spotted the figures moving slowly towards the castle and let out a low whistle. Murphy raised his hand, suspecting a trap, and the 3 GIs behind him froze. "This is a Yank," Nunn shouted. "There's a prison up here. The commandant wants to surrender. It's all yours." Still, Murphy hesitated. Nunn now came up with what he later considered a stroke of genius. "This is kosher," he shouted. No German guard would ever have used a Yiddish word. The GIs moved forward. They looked menacing. Their faces were smeared with lampblack. They bristled with hand grenades and ammunition. A figure wearing tartan trousers and a bonnet with red feather cockade stepped out from the gateway arch with hand extended. "Welcome to Colditz," said Walker. "We've been waiting a long time. Would you like a cup of coffee?" The German garrison was lined up in the courtyard of the Kommandantur, as if on parade. Eggers stepped forward and proffered a neatly typed sheet of paper. "Officer Special Camp 4C, 1,500 Allied officers and men, all unhurt. Nominal role herewith." Murphy had never seen a live German soldier at such close quarters before, let alone accepted a surrender. But with all the authority he could muster, he told Eggers to disarm his men and stack the guns in a room at the base of the watchtower. Pravit stood erect and expressionless. Leaving two of the Americans to supervise, Murphy allowed Nunn and Walker to lead him to the gate of the inner courtyard, which stood ajar. He pushed open the huge oak doors. Todd had ordered the men to remain in their quarters, but a few of the senior officers were already milling around the courtyard. They turned as the apparition entered the gloomy interior of the castle. A fresh-faced man, hardly out of his teens, festooned with weapons. They stared. He was filthy from battle, steel-helmeted, and armed to the teeth. Murphy was also very nervous. The prisoners suddenly surged towards him. Alarmed, Murphy unslung his M1 and pointed it at the ragged mob converging on him. "Stay back, stay back!" For a few seconds, they all stood still. A strange standoff between allies. "We're friends, friends," they urged. Murphy lowered his gun. The next instant, all hell broke loose. The men flooded forward, and Murphy was swamped by an ecstatic throng, laughing and cheering. Dozens of hands clapped him on the back with such force his knees buckled. A few of the prisoners held back, disbelieving, stunned. Some wept. Hundreds of others had by now gathered at the windows, whooping and bellowing. At this moment, Private Frank Gignas, Jr. entered the courtyard. As we stepped into view, a roar of cheers greeted us from the windows overlooking the yard. I could see faces at every window. A working-class youth from New Jersey, Gignas was carrying a large portrait of Adolf Hitler. He had found it on the wall of the German mess and intended to keep it as a souvenir. A lively barter system existed among the GIs. Watches, weapons, belt buckles, knives, and other items were all collected by the advancing army as trade items or mementos. A framed Führer was worth several hundred cigarettes. But Gignas had a theatrical bent. On a whim, he raised the picture of Hitler high above his head with both hands and turned in a slow arc so that all could see. Then he crashed the picture across his raised knee. There was pandemonium. The shouts and cheers echoed in the narrow confines of the courtyard. The events of the next few hours took on an unreal quality. "It felt like we were making a movie," said Robert Miller, one of the original quartet of GIs. Jeeps had started to arrive at the castle gates, disgorging more troops. Each American soldier entering the courtyard was loudly embraced, backslapped, invited to breakfast in the mess. Some of the former prisoners felt a twinge of embarrassment at the physical contrast between these beefy, corn-fed GIs and their own pallid and scrawny bodies. Colonel William Schaefer, so recently under sentence of death, was brought out to meet his countrymen, shaking uncontrollably, tears streaming down his face. Pravit and his senior officers were herded together at gunpoint and marched down to the town, over the bridge, where the body of a boy of about 14 lay spread-eagled. the Hitler Youth Band on one arm, a flattened Panzerfaust beside him. The face of the child was palish green. Eggers wondered, what made them die like this? On the far bank stood the dead boy's mother, torn with grief. Desperate to retrieve her son's body, her way was barred by an American corporal with orders not to let any Germans through. The town undertaker had already arrived with a horse-drawn hearse, like a stage prop from a Wild West movie. The advancing Americans had by now established a temporary command headquarters in the town hotel. The formal surrender of Colditz Castle took place in the saloon. Pravitz stepped forward, saluted, and presented his sheathed sabre and pistol to Colonel Leo Shaughnessy of the 273rd Infantry. The commandant and his 16 officers were then marched away to the jail through jeering, shoving crowds of GIs. One of Pravitz's epaulets was ripped off. Locked into the cells where so many prisoners had been consigned to solitary confinement, Eggers reflected that his world had now truly turned upside down. I must learn the feel of the other end of the stick. I was the POW now. The town square, deserted and hostile a few hours earlier, became a scene of jubilation as the inhabitants emerged, greeting the Americans with food and flowers. Just 5 months before, the townsfolk had turned out to celebrate the anniversary of the Nazis' rise to power. Overnight, collective amnesia set in. The swastikas and copies of Mein Kampf quietly disappeared. The inhabitants of Colditz forgot their recent history and then rewrote it. In the town, it seemed there were no Nazis, Green observed. Everybody had hated them for years and had worked secretly against them. In an imposing private house on the other side of town, a drinks party was underway, symbolising the dramatic transformation in the town's politics. Private Murphy escorted Chenek Kalupka to meet in person, for the first time, Herr Schmidt, linchpin of the Colditz spy network and the gentleman who was to become the burgomaster when the Allies took charge of the town. Checo struck Murphy as a Clark Gable type, the black hair, good-looking, etc. Schmidt warmly welcomed them with champagne. The Czech pilot seemed quite at home in Schmidt's elegant parlour, but Murphy was suddenly self-conscious. I really hated to enter his beautiful home, as dirty as I was, or sit on his furniture and drink a glass of wine. Lee Carson was in a very bad mood. This tall woman in khaki uniform came marching up, recalled one of the GIs. She was just furious. Every journalist lives for a scoop, and she had been denied one. She was supposed to be there for the capture of Colditz and to have the exclusive story. But Carson had arrived half an hour too late. The sight of the dead German boy lying on the bridge had further upset her. Shooting children is murder, she told the military minder, whose impossible job it was to try to control her. Carson brushed past the guard and marched into the courtyard. The arrival of a very attractive blonde carrying a helmet and camera sent excitement levels among the newly liberated inmates soaring to new heights. Most had not seen a young woman in 5 years, let alone one who appeared to have materialized from a glamour magazine. The entrance of this rather smashing American female war correspondent dressed in a boiler suit threatened to start a riot. Carson was immediately surrounded by a scrum of men, most of whom, Julius Green noted wryly, appeared to be Douglas Bader. The celebrated double amputee flying ace was amazed to see a girl, a real live girl, in battle dress in the courtyard. He swooped instantly. Carson had been in Colditz less than a minute before Bader offered her an exclusive interview. The report of Bader's liberation was so glowing he might have written it himself.
Debonair Wing Commander Douglas Bader wants most of all to get another squirt at the bloody Hun, now that he is free from German internment. "Just give me one more shot at those goons," begged the 35-year-old fighter pilot, who became one of Britain's great aces with two artificial legs. The laughing, dark-haired hero was one of a thousand or so liberated from the great, grey Colditz prison. Carson was taken on a tour of the prison's best-kept secrets. The radio hideaway, where the news had been gathered nightly for 2 years, and then up into the attics. That morning, the glider builders had fully assembled the Colditz cock for the first time. The GIs queued up to stare at it, a complete aircraft constructed in absolute secrecy from floorboards, bedposts and mattress covers, an astonishing feat of aeronautical engineering. "My God, it was incredible," recalled one American soldier. "I was thinking, how could they do that?" Lee Carson took the first, last and only photograph of the glider. The machine is poised as if staring out of the top floor windows of Colditz, contemplating a flight it would never take. As Lee Carson was leaving, Douglas Bader climbed into the back of the Jeep alongside her, carrying a holdall packed by his orderly, Alex Ross. Todd had given orders that no officer was to leave the castle without permission, but rules did not apply to Bader. By the next day, he was back in Paris, and a day after that, he returned to Britain and a hero's welcome. The first prisoner to make a home run from Colditz after its liberation, several days before anyone else. Lee Carson's report flew around the world. The Yank force drove to the camp despite well-organized resistance. Every town had to be fought through, but in less than 24 hours the tanks, with doughboys riding topside, blasted their way through to the medieval castle. 5 American officers were rescued, along with 350 British, 1,000 French, and a handful of Poles, she wrote. But the last chapter of the Colditz story was still being written. Carson's report was headlined, "Allied Hostages Hidden in Nazi Redoubt," and reported, 21 prominent British and American prisoners have been taken to Adolf Hitler's headquarters in the so-called National Redoubt as hostages, taken from their cells and loaded into a truck for their trip to Hitler's last-ditch refuge. The American task force arrived 48 hours too late. In Tittmoning camp, the disappearance of the Prominente, Giles Romilly and the 5 others entombed inside the wall, provoked panic among their jailers and a massive manhunt. 3,000 German soldiers combed the surrounding countryside. The castle was searched from cellar to battlements. After 3 days of frantic hunting, the 5 men were found, possibly through a tip-off, in their cramped hiding place. "How silly of you to try to escape now," said the commandant, aware that his own life would have been forfeit had they succeeded. Romilly was still missing. The remaining special prisoners were transferred, along with the Poles, to Laufen Castle near Salzburg, and placed in a special enclosure surrounded by barbed wire and double guards. The SS was not going to lose its grip on these valuable captives a second time. But the Prominente also had a last line of defence, in the shape of one exceptionally dogged Swiss official. Rudolf Denzler appeared at the camp the next morning, as ill-shaven and competent as usual, and demanded to see the prisoners. He explained that he had taken lodgings in the town and was keeping a close watch. If they were moved from the castle, he would immediately inform his boss, the Swiss minister, Peter Feldscher, head of the foreign interest section at the Swiss embassy in Berlin. He studied the prisoners benignly through his pince-nez. "Everything seems to be in order," he said. There was something naive but deeply reassuring in Densler's unshakable belief that official regulations would confound anything the Nazis might attempt. That faith was about to be put to the test, because when Densler returned to see the prisoners the following day, he was instead ushered into the commandant's office. On the desk lay a written order, signed by SS Obergruppenführer Gottlob Berger himself, stating that Oberst Fritz Meurer would be coming to collect the Prominente within 24 hours. Meurer was the SS officer who had organized the murder of French General Gustav Meini 3 months earlier. Densler swung into action. From the telephone in the lobby of the Erste Reichische Hotel in Salzburg, he informed Minister Feldscher of the new situation. He then drove 30 miles east to Schloss Fuschel, private residence of the German Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop, to warn the highest level of what was left of German foreign politics that a major violation of international diplomacy was about to take place. Next, he tracked down every high-ranking German army officer he could find in the area, including the general in command of Salzburg's sector. At each stop, the response was the same. Acting against the SS was dangerous. Finally, he reached the headquarters of Field Marshal Kesselring, in a hotel just a few miles from Berchtesgaden. Kesselring's chief of staff, General Wilhelm Seidel, was friendly and pleasant, but unhelpful. Densler wrote, "He was shrugging his shoulders, which gave away his attitude. If injustice is done, it is done by others. I am washing my hands of this." The Wehrmacht was obviously powerless in a Reich within days of total collapse. Two buses were waiting at the gates of Laufen Camp next morning. As the Prominente were being herded into them, a black Mercedes drew up, and out stepped a tall figure in a long black leather coat almost to his ankles. His cap bore the death's head emblem of the SS. Meurer had brought along his mistress, a hard-faced blonde, wearing trousers and smoking a cigarette through a long holder. "The whole scene had a gangster-like atmosphere," wrote Elphinstone, the group's senior officer. "We entered the transport with the colonel fingering his revolver, watching us." The buses started up, and Michael Alexander felt a lurch of fear. We were now in a malignant world of purely arbitrary hostility. The protective hand of the Wehrmacht had been removed. They were now at the mercy of the SS. But suddenly, as we drove out, we saw, crouching behind a kiosk, a familiar figure, wearing an enormous grey trilby hat pulled down over his eyes. It was the faithful Mr. Densler. As we passed, he gave us a conspiratorial wave. Our departure had been noticed. A lifeline was still out. Rudolf Densler joined the back of the convoy, a tall Swiss bureaucrat in a small car, with spots of blood on his shirt collar. Obergruppenführer Gottlob Berger was summoned to the Führerbunker in Berlin. The Red Army was closing in. The last act would be played out in the ruins of Hitler's capital. But the Führer had unfinished revenge in mind. Berger found Hitler ill and demented, purple with rage, blaming everyone else for losing the war, ranting and raving about this betrayal and that act of disloyalty. According to Berger, the enraged Führer ordered him to fly to Bavaria, where the Prominente had been taken as hostages. His hand was shaking, his leg was shaking, and his head was shaking. And all that he kept saying was, "Shoot them all! Shoot them all!" Berger commandeered Himmler's private plane and flew south. Munich, the capital of the movement in Nazi geography, fell to American forces without a fight. Giles Romilly was standing on a street corner in the northwest suburbs when the first American tank rolled into the city. It travelled past slowly, unseeing and curiously gentle, like a blind man crossing a road. It was covered in flowers. Romilly's escape from captivity had been long, hard, and boring. By train and on foot, he and his Dutch companion had slogged west from Tittmoning, sleeping in bombed-out buildings and hay barns, scrounging just enough food to survive. In the villages, the people were too exhausted and terrified to take much notice of two more refugees toiling westward. After a week, utterly spent, they reached the outskirts of Munich and knocked on the door of a house near an estate. No special reason to pick it, we just did. The door was opened by a woman with a pleasant face, neither pretty nor plain, who agreed to take them in as lodgers. She fed them, laid out deck chairs in the garden under an apple tree, and prepared clean beds in her spare room. Her name was Magda. She never asked us who we were or what we were doing. Her husband was in the Waffen SS. She had not seen him for 3 years. Romilly wondered if her kindness to us had any motive, and concluded that there was none, save a desire for company. Amid the destruction and cruelty, he had accidentally stumbled into a small and unexpected patch of human sympathy. Romilly presented himself at 6th Army headquarters and felt, for the first time, the anxiety of my newborn freedom. The Americans put Churchill's nephew on the first plane to Paris, and that evening he found himself the guest of honour in the middle of a roaring party at the chic Hotel Scrieb. Dazed, I gyrated in a haze of smiles, hands, drinks, cigarettes, glittering lights. Joltingly, he was back in some wonderful Parisian fairy story. But it could not feel real. The dull, stinging oppression of the past was rooted in his soul. The story did not end, he wrote. Giles Romilly never fully escaped from Colditz. My 5 years of absence were like a deep shaft. I at the bottom, able to see the free people overhead, not able to make them see or hear me. The Prominente convoy wound slowly around the hairpin bends of the Bavarian Alps. Rudolf Denzler, keeping them in sight as far as possible, tucked in behind the black Mercedes carrying Oberst Moira and the rather sinister-looking blonde woman. The roads were crowded with military vehicles of every description. They were now deep inside Hitler's Alpine fortress. At strategic points, boulders had been piled up on the mountainsides. When the order came, explosives beneath them would be detonated to create artificial landslides to block the passes and roads, sealing off the redoubt. The buses passed a signpost for Berchtesgaden and continued west, deep into the mountains. It was late afternoon when they reached Marktpongau Camp, Stalag 18C. The prisoners were locked into a dismal hut. The Swiss, meanwhile, were struggling to trace the only man with authority to intervene. SS Obergruppenführer Gottlob Berger was not easy to find, wrote Denzler. He was practically on the run, and any talk of his whereabouts could be interpreted as treason. But after a few discreet telephone calls, the Swiss had informants inside German high command, the general was located, holed up in a remote farmhouse with his SS retinue. The Swiss minister put through a call and made an appeal, not to Berger's better nature, because he did not have one, but to his self-interest, which he had in spades. The only way to save the Prominente, Denzler knew, was to convince Berger that it would be to his personal advantage if he handed over his prominent prisoners. The next afternoon, another black Mercedes pulled up outside the prisoner's hut. In the back sat a portly figure propped up on pillows. Berger himself. Almighty Gottlob entered the hut, wrote Michael Alexander, smoking a large cigar and swaying as if slightly drunk. He bowed as if in the presence of royalty, which he was, gestured at the prisoners to be seated, handed out whiskey and cigarettes, and then launched into a prepared speech. Any crimes committed by the Nazi regime, concentration camps and so on, had been the work of the Gestapo and the SD, not the Waffen-SS, of which he was a general. Indeed, he disapproved of these activities. Germany had gone to war to hold back Bolshevism, the Red Virus, and had no quarrel with Britain and America, let alone with his distinguished audience. He described his visit to the Führerbunker and Hitler's demented order to kill them all. His refusal to do so, he claimed, had now earned him his own death sentence as a defeatist. So he was now being hunted, as were they, by stormtroopers under the command of SS General Ernst Kaltenbrunner, a fanatical Nazi loyalist. It was a remarkably cynical performance. War criminal, murderer, enslaver of children and abject coward, Berger was trying to save his own skin, and dressing this up as an act of principle, even self-sacrifice. He was no longer the jailer of the Prominente, he insisted, but their saviour. Swiss officials would convey them to the American lines. He would provide an SS escort with orders to defend them and a letter of safe conduct signed by himself. Gentlemen, General Berger declared solemnly, rising to his feet, these are probably the last orders I shall give as a high official of the Third Reich. This was also the first time the craven Berger had disobeyed a Nazi order. He was acting not out of clemency or courage, but wily calculation. Delivering the Prominente to the Allies might just save him from the hangman's noose when the war was over. Berger was not the only one scrambling for survival as the Nazi state collapsed. The bus drivers had slipped away with the buses. Oberst Meurer and his blonde mistress had vanished in their Mercedes. Instead, the prisoners woke the next morning to find a waiting Buick with diplomatic plates containing a young Swiss official named Werner Buchmüller. Elegantly dressed and as charmingly casual as if he was just dropping in for a drink, summoned by Denzler to accompany the group as extra diplomatic protection. Denzler somehow managed to conjure up two army lorries, and from the boot of his car, Buchmüller produced two enormous Swiss flags, which he draped over the bonnets. It was dark before they all set off. The British officers and the American Wynant in one lorry, the Poles in the other, accompanied by the Swiss in the Buick, and a squad of stormtroopers armed with anti-tank weapons. Various Nazi chiefs, including Kaltenbrunner, were lurking somewhere in these mountains, each with his private band of desperate retainers, and might try to snatch them. Berger held the royal flush, as Michael Alexander put it, and he was not going to surrender a winning hand. Half an hour later, the convoy shuddered to a halt. We saw in the dim rays of the headlights the figure of an SS soldier waving a gun and signalling us to turn to the right. After jolting up a steep dirt track, they turned into the courtyard of a substantial farmhouse. A door was thrown open. A shaft of light shone out, and the prisoners and their Swiss protectors entered a surreal scene. Before them stood a long table illuminated with lamps and candles, groaning with food and drink, a feast such as prison-conditioned eyes had not seen for a long time. Cold meats, smoked fish, crystallized fruit, bottles of French wine and American whiskey. A huge fire roared in the grate. Alexander described a spectacle of debauchery from another age. On the floor, about 20 SS men, boys almost, lay sprawled like retainers on a Saxon hearth. They were half undressed and seemed too tired or too drunk to be interested in our presence. Gottlob Berger was back for an encore. The pudgy Obergruppenführer entered the room wearing a white mess jacket, which gave him, Alexander observed, the appearance of an American businessman on vacation in Palm Beach. The general was sozzled and launched into another ingratiating political homily, identical to the one he had delivered the previous day. "England and Germany are blood brothers of the same Aryan stock," he slurred. Berger paid no attention to the Swiss officials and ignored General Bor Komorowski and his entourage. The Poles were not about to win the war and were therefore irrelevant. His peroration over, Berger clapped his hands and a white uniformed retainer appeared, carrying a scarlet leather case. Inside, on a red velvet cushion, lay a large automatic pistol, inlaid with ivory, the barrel chased with gold oak leaves in bas-relief, the butt engraved with Berger's signature and the insignia of the SS. This had been, the general proudly declared, a personal gift from the Führer, and now he was presenting it to his British friends as proof of his good wishes. Each officer was offered a fat cigar. Alas, history does not record whether these were made by H. Upman Limited. At 5 a.m., Berger finally staggered off to bed, and the Prominente, gorged on Nazi food and drink, clambered back onto the lorries, taking with them a sinister SS souvenir from one of the nastiest parties in history. At dawn, the convoy passed through a final German command post, manned by exhausted-looking, sweaty troops, and came to the Inn Valley. They watched us with a curiously detached air as we sailed past, immune under our neutral flag, towards our salvation and their probable destruction. The convoy entered a strangely tranquil no-man's land. A little white church shone in the morning sun. 20 minutes later, a line of 3 stubby American tanks came rumbling into view. The next morning, clean and rested, the Prominente were having breakfast at the headquarters of the U.S. 53rd Division in Innsbruck when a call came through for John Elphinstone. The Queen was on the line. "Would it be possible to come home directly and quickly?" Elphinstone asked his aunt. The Queen said she would speak to the King, and by the following evening, the royal former prisoners of Colditz were sitting down to a family dinner party in Buckingham Palace. By then, Colditz Castle was empty. The Americans had told the prisoners they would be leaving in 2 days' time and to take only 1 item of luggage each. Mickey Byrne carefully packed the manuscript of his finished novel. Grizz Davis Scarfield wandered down to the cemetery to visit the grave of Michael Sinclair. Willie Todd pointed out that SS squads might be roaming the countryside and suggested the men stay inside the castle. It was advice, not an order, and widely ignored. Checo Kalupka, David Sterling, and Jack Pringle moved into a large abandoned townhouse and began a riotous 48-hour party. At the old China factory, the GIs discovered a handful of Jewish prisoners who had survived the SS massacre. Julius Green was appalled when they were brought to the castle sickbay. Living skeletons were lying on the beds, quite unconscious, arms and legs like matchsticks and bodies covered in sores and bruises. One of them was an eminent Budapest doctor. They were now being treated by American medics, but Green could tell most would not live long. They were in a dreadful state of emaciation, some of them with gunshot wounds, and all desperately ill. Those I saw had been left for dead, or had hidden. The Jewish dentist was not a man of violence, but the sight of the dying Hungarians triggered something savage in him. German civilians had been instructed to surrender weapons at the police station. I picked myself a nice automatic and a few clips, and then went around with an American jeep, trying to see if any of the SS were about, and requiring our attention. As usual, Green's tone was jocular, but his intentions were murderous. Had this gentle dentist been able to find any stormtroopers, he would have killed them. On the 18th of April, the men were loaded onto US Army trucks driven by black American servicemen who gunned their engines and set off at full throttle. Dick Howe, the former escape officer, commandeered a motorbike and led the convoy out of the castle gates. Each of the lorries was equipped with a machine gun mounted on the cab. Julius Green was selected to sit behind the weapon and scan the roadsides in case of ambush. I had never fired a machine gun and wasn't quite sure how this one worked. A journey of 100 miles brought the convoy to an airfield near Chemnitz. After a night in a barn, sleeping on soft straw, they climbed onto Dakota transport planes. Most had never been in an aircraft before. Green was airsick all the way to England. I would have welcomed any German fighter that tried to shoot us down. At Westcott Airfield near Aylesbury, a really delicious volunteer from the Women's Voluntary Service with a clipboard passed among the prisoners, asking, "Is Captain Green here?" I indicated that indeed he was, Green later wrote, and she should reject all impostors. The smiling woman told him to report to the War Office in the morning, where he would be debriefed on his intelligence activities inside Colditz. He caught the next train to London. Like many returning prisoners, Green was bewildered to be suddenly roaming the streets of the capital, unfettered and unguarded. His mind ranged back over his captivity, the boredom, fear and frustration, but also the occasional unlikely satisfaction in humour, friendship and espionage. Like every Colditz prisoner, he had been put to the test and wondered if he had passed. No one can predict how they will behave in enforced, unexpected and lengthy captivity. Colditz contained every sort of person, and they responded in every kind of way, with courage or cowardice, anger or wit, kindness or cruelty, resistance or rebellion. "If I had been cleverer and braver, I might have been more useful," wrote Green. This was typically modest, and quite wrong. As a skilled dentist, few had been more useful, and as a Jew in Nazi hands and a spy sending back coded messages, none had been more brave. London felt alien, friendly but foreign after so long spent behind barbed wire and stone walls. Britain was still at war. German bombs had gouged great holes in the city. Many of the shops and restaurants remained boarded up. Just 3 weeks earlier, one of Hitler's V-2 rockets had landed on a three-story housing block in the East End, killing 134 civilians. That was the last bomb to fall on London. The night streets were being lit once more after 5 years of blackout, but people still scurried along the pavements, occasionally glancing anxiously upward. No one paid any attention to the lone soldier who wandered slowly through Piccadilly, as if lost and searching for something. Green knew he had changed. He was 2.5 stone thinner, graver than the carefree soldier medic who had left England in January 1940, and older than by the sum of the lost years. His frayed uniform hung off him like a sack. Whenever a passerby came near, he instinctively flinched, backing into doorways. Everyone else seemed to have somewhere to go. Throughout his imprisonment, Green had never been more than a few feet away from another prisoner. Humans need space as much as company, and now he had to navigate liberty, the suddenly limitless expanse of a life so recently confined. In Colditz, he had known the name of every other inmate, their voices and stories, their fears, their teeth, and the smell of their breath. These hurried Londoners in a city waking from war no longer knew him, and never could. He was alone, and he was free. He was also very hungry. My first thought was to treat myself to the meal I had been dreaming about for 4 years. Julius Green, dentist, gourmand, spy and unsung war hero, settled into a corner table in a restaurant off Regent Street and savoured the taste of freedom. Smoked salmon, minestrone, roast beef, pineapple and kirsch, followed by coffee and a good brandy.